The Fourth Amendment reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrant shall issue but based upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Just like any other part of the Constitution, we have to know the history and intent behind the drafting of the Fourth Amendment to properly understand it. Remember Patrick Henry said, "I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that's the lamp of experience. I know no way to judge the future but by the past." The purpose of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is to secure the blessings of liberty for present and future generations. How do we know we're successful? By knowing our history and not repeating its mistakes. History and the wisdom it reveals guided the designers of our Constitution, and it has to guide us as well. The principles of the Fourth Amendment were codified in British Liberty Charters, beginning with the Magna Carta of 1215. By the 1700s, this right of the people to be secure in their property was an established matter of law for the American colonists for over 500 years. So when the British government began trampling those rights, the issue wasn't whether those rights existed, but that the British agents were abusing them. The dispute over property rights really began to escalate when Parliament passed the Navigation Act of 1760, which mandated that the American colonists purchase only certain goods approved by the British government and supplied by British ships. This mandate of purchases became even more offensive to the colonists when Parliament began assessing consumption taxes on these mandated purchases. In other words, you have to buy it and we're going to tax you on it. The colonists saw this taxation as a direct assault upon their liberty and upon their property rights. The colonists began pushing back by boycotting certain taxed items and by purchasing items contrary to the established law. These colonists didn't believe they were breaking the law by refusing to follow Parliament's new laws. They believed Parliament was violating their original Liberty Charters and the self-evident natural rights of the people. It may be tempting to think that the issue the people had with their government was about money involved in taxation, but it was not about money. It was about the property rights of the people being violated through unlawful taxation. These British citizens in their American colonies were asserting that the Stamp Act violated every right to property that existed by natural law and every right to defend that property pursuant to natural law through their government's unlawful seizing of their property. Samuel Adams wrote in 1772 about the national rights of the colonists. He said, "Among the natural rights of the colonists are these. First, a right to life. Secondly, liberty. Thirdly, to property, together with the right to support and defend them in the best manner they can." He says these are evident branches of, rather than deductions from, the duty of self-preservation, commonly called the first law of nature. The American British colonists were raised with the understanding that ownership and defense of their property was a natural right, not one that was given to them by the king or by Parliament. So to see the king and Parliament taking their property contrary to the natural rights of the people was really offensive on many levels. The anger of the colonists against this taking of their property was really inflamed by Parliament's passing of the Writs of Assistance Law in 1760. Because of the colonial boycotts and the defiance of Parliament's laws, the government agents could not enforce the laws. Taxes were not being collected, and the colonists were not purchasing the goods they were required to purchase. To enforce these laws, Parliament passed the Writs of Assistance Laws, authorizing custom agents and tax collectors to search and seize the colonial homes without following the laws established by laws of due process. Parliament claimed that the dissenters refusing to purchase the mandated items were committing acts of treason and were a threat to the well-being of the kingdom. It was necessary then for Parliament to temporarily set aside certain restrictions on government power in order to enforce the law and stop the criminals, they claimed. These writs of assistance empowered tax collectors and customs agents to search and seize goods from colonial homes contrary to the colonists' rights to due process. These writs literally gave every individual agent the arbitrary and unchecked power to search and seize any item they chose under the color of law. Some agents were not limiting their searches to the taxed items. Some agents were seizing items out of greed, and some to establish business advantage. The seizing of items was not limited to goods. Some agents, finding themselves with completely unchecked power, took advantage of that power, and in satisfying their personal lusts, were searching and seizing our wives and daughters. These writs were not only a violation of the guaranteed right of all Englishmen, but had become something even more nefarious. James Otis Jr. was an attorney in 1760. He'd received from the king the highest appointment that any attorney could achieve. Otis was in charge of enforcing the laws of the crown and ensuring that the colonists were properly prosecuted for their crimes. Now, Otis's father was also an attorney and raised Otis in the knowledge of British law and liberty charters. Because of this education in liberty, Otis became conflicted by the job the government was asking him to do and his knowledge and understanding of liberty. Because of these writs and their direct violation of English law and liberty, Otis resigned his post. Now, Otis could have gone back to a quiet practice of law, but that was not the kind of man Otis was. He could not remain quiet in the knowledge that the government entrusted with protecting the rights of the people was violating that trust and those rights. Otis became a whistleblower. Otis began publishing pamphlets and writing articles to inform American colonists about the government's violation of their rights. One of these pamphlets is titled, "The Rights of the British Colonies Asserted and Proved," where Otis taught of the limited authority of government to tax and seize property and the superior nature of the natural rights of the people. He would speak to and teach whomever would listen. However, in 1760, there was no liberty movement. No committees of correspondence had been formed, and there were no Sons of Liberty. Otis's warnings were not well received by many in the community. He was threatened with loss of business. He was called every name in the book but a good Christian man. He was one of the only voices of liberty at this time, and by far the most bold and public of these voices. He wrote and spoke without anonymity and took the brunt of all criticism because he believed it to be his duty in liberty. Otis said this. He said, "I can sincerely declare that I cheerfully submit myself to every odious name for conscience' sake. And from my soul I despise all those whose guilt, malice, or folly has made them my foes." In Otis' experience, he knew that there were people who were acting for the destruction of the liberty of the people. There were those in power who were denying the people liberty because they were ignorant and didn't know any better. They were the folly. And there were those in power who were denying the people liberty because they felt it was necessary to sacrifice principle on the altar of pragmatism. They are the guilty. And he knew that there were those in power who were denying people liberty because they were wicked and power hungry. They are the malice. His point was, whether the reason is ignorance, compromise, or wickedness, at the end of the day, it makes no difference, as the results are exactly the same. The people have lost their liberty. Otis is teaching us these people are not our representatives. They are not our friends. They are our foes, the foes of liberty. In February of 1761, Otis would take on a legal case regarding these writs of assistance that would most literally change the world. We will learn of this case in the next class. In 1761, James Otis Jr. was approached by two business owners whose businesses had been particularly ravaged by a greedy British agent. These men asked Otis to help them file a case against this agent and ultimately against the writs of assistance themselves. Otis agreed to take the case, and in February of 1761, he would argue before the courts for 5 solid hours. He argued these writs of assistance were the worst instruments of arbitrary power, the most destructive of English liberty ever found in an English law book. At the end of the day, the court would not even render an opinion, but declared they would take the matter under advisement. What that means is that all of Otis' work and sacrifice changed nothing about the application of this tyrannical law. Although the law was not changed that day, something more important and more powerful was birthed that day, a passion in the hearts of the people for the preservation of their rights to life, liberty, and property. In that courtroom that day was John Adams, Samuel Adams, Dr. James Warren, and many of the men who would become the liberty movement that would birth the independence of America. Otis's argument before the court that day was a pivotal moment in history, so powerful that John Adams would write about it 40 years later. John Adams wrote, "But Otis was a flame of fire, with a promptitude of classical allusions, a depth of research, a rapid summary of historical events and dates, a profusion of legal authorities, a prophetic glare of his eyes into the future, and a rapid torrent of impetuous eloquence. He hurried away all before him. American independence, Adams said, was then and there born. The seeds of patriots and heroes to defend the vigorous youth were then and there sown." Adams said, "Every man of an immense crowded audience appeared to me to go away as I did, ready to take up arms against writs of assistance. Then and there was the first scene of the first act of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain. Then and there, the child of independence was born." Adams would finish his thought by saying in 15 years, namely in 1776, that child grew up to manhood and declared himself free. From this amazing event, James Otis Jr. was evermore considered by the founders of America as the midwife to liberty. This one man taking a stand for the liberty of all, sacrificing his life, his reputation, his profession, changed the world. Although the events of that particular day likely felt like defeat, we need to remember in the battle for liberty, we must think differently about the terms of victory and defeat. Sometimes taking a stand and planting a seed for the future is more valuable than feeling the immediate and present effects of victory. Otis knew this. This is the value of liberty that Otis understood. This is why he said, "Consequences be as they may, I am determined to proceed." We need to notice that what Otis was fighting for was the liberty of property rights. James Madison wrote an essay called Property. In this essay, he made a very important observation. He said, "It is not a just government, nor is property secure under it, where the property which a man has in his personal safety and personal liberty is violated by arbitrary seizures of one class of citizens for the service of the rest. A magistrate issuing his warrants to a press gang would be in his proper functions in Turkey or Indistan, under appellations proverbial of the most complete despotism." Madison was speaking of an important principle of liberty, that when those in government do not respect the property rights of the people, when those in government are able to take the property of the people without proper due process, simply by force and color of law, that government must be classified as a completely despotic government. Madison also explains in this essay that the British government was not only despotic for taking property unlawfully, but for not protecting the property of the people from unlawful takings. Government's only purpose, Madison says, is to protect the rights and the property of the people. He says, "Government is instituted to protect property of every sort, as well as that which lies in the various rights of the individuals, and that which the term particularly expresses." He says, "This being the end of government, that alone is a just government, which impartially secures to every man whatever is his own. The rights of the people, to include the right to property, precedes all government. Government was created for the sole purpose of securing the rights of the people." Otis made this point when he wrote, "The end of government being the good of mankind points out its great duties. It is above all things to provide for the security, the quiet, and happy enjoyment of life, liberty, and property." For the designers of our constitutional republic, the right to be secure in the possessions and the defense of property is a natural right, one that does not come from government, but comes from the nature of our existence, our creation. Remember what Samuel Adams said in 1772. Among the natural rights of the colonists are these: first, a right to life; secondly, liberty; thirdly, to property, together with the right to support and defend them in the best manner they can. He says these are the evident branches of, rather than the deductions from, the duty of self-preservation, commonly called the first law of nature. That third right, the right to property, is no less inherent right than the right to life, liberty, or defense. All these rights stem from the first law of nature, the duty of self-preservation. Our founders knew all too well that the greatest threat to liberty was not the rogue bandit or gang of thieves, but to whom the people voluntarily gave power only to see them abuse that trust to the violation of the rights of the people. This is the situation they found themselves in with the writs of assistance in 1760. A government whose sole purpose was to defend the liberties of the people had turned on that purpose and become the enemy of liberty. The Stamp Act became the symbol of this violation of the property rights of all British citizens. The colonists knew that the agents enforcing these laws were in violation of their duty to secure the rights of the people. To help us better understand the real issue, we can look to the document written some years later, where the people are expressing their grievances against their government over this violation of their rights. On February 27, 1776, Richard Henry Lee published the Westmoreland Resolves, a resolution of the people of Westmoreland and Leedstown regarding the violation of the people's rights by the enforcement of the Stamp Act. You'll remember Lee from our state sovereignty class as the author of the Lee Resolution of June 7, 1776, the document that established the states as sovereign governments independent from Great Britain. Lee was one of the first founders of the Committees of Correspondence. He served as a representative of the Virginia House of Burgesses and a delegate to the First Continental Congress, where he would author the Lee Resolution. Lee wrote in the Westmoreland Resolves, "As we know it to be the birthright privilege of every British subject and of the people of Virginia as being such, founded on reason, law, and compact, that he cannot be legally tried but by his peers, and that he cannot be taxed but by consent of Parliament, in which he is represented by persons chosen by the people, and who themselves pay a part of the tax imposed on others." Lee continues and says, "As the Stamp Act does absolutely direct the property of the people to be taken from them without their consent expressed by their representatives, and as in many cases it deprives the British American subjects of his right to a trial by jury." We got to recognize the designers of our Constitution believed that a taxation of the people contrary to their liberty charters, contrary to their Constitution, was an unlawful taking of property. Every British citizen was guaranteed a security of their property and the requirement of the government to follow the proper laws of due process before they had the legal authority to take personal property. That due process was specifically a right to a trial by jury of their peers. Since the assessment of and collection of these taxes occurred outside the proper boundaries of their constitution, we must then also recognize that the enforcement of these laws of taxation and the collection of these unlawful taxes were most literally seen as criminal theft of the property by their government. Listen to how the Westmoreland Resolves talks about these acts. It says, "We do determine, at every hazard, and paying no regard to danger or to death, we will exert every faculty to prevent the execution of the said Stamp Act in any instance whatsoever within this colony. And every abandoned wretch who shall be so lost to virtue and public good as to wickedly contribute to the introduction or fixture of the Stamp Act in this colony, by using stamped paper or by any other means, we will, with the utmost expedition, convince all such profligates that immediate danger and disgrace shall attend their prostitute purpose." This is the history that drove the designers of our constitutional republic to codify the Fourth Amendment. It is this history that made it abundantly clear that a written declaration of the property rights of the people and the limited power of the government over those rights, This is the birth of our Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. How did we get from a history so strongly moored to the property rights of the people to a present day where the property of the people is more controlled by government than by those who own it? I believe, as Samuel Adams asserts, that this decline in the exercise of our natural rights to property comes through the universal ignorance of the people in understanding the fundamental meaning of the term property. In our next class, James Madison will teach us what the people of his day understood as common knowledge regarding the definition of the word property. In 1792, James Madison wrote an essay titled Property. In this essay, Madison attempts to explain not only the plain meaning of the term property, but the deeper and fuller meaning of this term demanded through the principles of natural law. Madison says of property, "This term, in its particular application, means that dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world, in exclusion to every other individual. If asked to define property today, I believe that definition is the one most people would recite. What is property? It's my stuff." But Madison explains the true meaning of the word property is much deeper than that. He says, "In its larger and juster meaning, it embraces everything to which a man may attach a value and have a right. Yes, property is your stuff, but not just your physical stuff. All stuff you value, all rights you possess." Madison explains further, "In the former sense, a man's land or merchandise or money is called his property. In the latter sense, a man has a property in his opinions and the free communication of them. He has a property of particular value in his religious opinions, in the profession and practice dictated by them. Your right to freedom of religion is property. Your right to the exercise of that religion is property." Madison says he has a property very dear to him in the safety and liberty of his person. Your right to defend your life, your liberty, and property is property. Madison says he has an equal property in the free use of his faculties, the free choice of the objects on which to employ them. Now, Noah Webster defines the term faculties as the power of the mind or intellect, power of performing any action, peculiar skill derived from practice, natural virtue. James Madison says all of these things are your property. Now, the Fourth Amendment declares that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Those terms, person, houses, paper, effects, are a list of every perceivable form of property that is to be owned by a person. In other words, as Madison said, everything to which a man may attach a value or have a right, everything that you can think, believe, use, possess, that is your property. And that property is to never be taken without proper application of due process. This fact is not an invention of the Fourth Amendment. It is a pre-established principle that predates our government and is established throughout history as a self-evident truth. The Fourth Amendment was written to establish this self-evident truth as a foundational principle of our constitutional republic, and it is written in plain English. There's no Latin terms, no complicated words, yet the Fourth Amendment might just be the most misinterpreted, abused, and disregarded principle in American society and government. Let's look at the text of the Fourth Amendment in light of the history we've just learned. The Fourth Amendment reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrant shall issue but based upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Most judges, lawyers, politicians, and professors will agree that the Fourth Amendment guarantees your right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. But they'll also agree that you are not free from all searches and seizures, only unreasonable ones. The debate and ultimate destruction of the principles of the Fourth Amendment are all hinged upon the definition of this term, reasonable. The educated elite will try to explain to you that you cannot know exactly what reasonable means. The courts have gone so far as to develop their own definition of reasonable. Any of you who have ever had a criminal justice class or a class on the Fourth Amendment have probably heard the court's definition of reasonable. It says, the reasonableness standard, as the courts have defined, is what a reasonable person would find reasonable under reasonable circumstances. That is what we call, in the field of logic, circular reasoning, using a term to define that term. But it is under this circular reasoning that the right to be secure in our property is whittled away. The judges, lawyers, politicians, and professors claim that this is the best they can do because there is no known definition of unreasonable in the Fourth Amendment. But that assertion is simply not true. The Fourth Amendment does not end after the words shall not be violated. There's an entire list of qualifiers that follows, providing the exact definition of reasonable search and seizure. Once again, it is not the failing of the text that creates confusion. It is the government defining the terms of their own power that establishes confusion so the people can be manipulated into allowing those in power to expand their own power. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, comma. And no warrant shall issue, but based upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. The Fourth Amendment establishes the precise criteria of a reasonable search and seizure. The reasonable search and seizure is one where there is a warrant that is based upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Every other search and seizure is an unreasonable search and seizure. Within this text is the very important legal term. It's often overlooked because it's not the first word you would think of when identifying the most important word. But it is vital to the proper understanding of this text nonetheless. That word is and. The use of the word and in the list, warrants based upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched, and the persons or things to be seized, means that all five elements must be present at the same time for the search and seizure to be reasonable. The word is and, not or. So all five must be there at the same time. Not 3 out of 5, not 4 out of 5, not 4 out of 4.5 out of 5. All five must be there, or the search and seizure is unreasonable and is therefore prohibited by the term shall not. In our last class, we'll talk about the exceptions to your right to be secure in your property as established by the Fourth Amendment. If the people are not free from all searches and seizures, then there must be exceptions to the right of property. What are those exceptions? And can we know them, or do we need the Supreme Court to define them for us? When we look at the Fourth Amendment, it becomes clear that there is only one exception to your right to be secure in all your property. That one exception requires five elements to be present all at the same time. The only time your property is subject to search and seizure is when there is a warrant based upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. If those five things are not present, then your property rights are being violated. Can you find any other exceptions written within the Fourth Amendment to your right to be secure in your property? Does the Fourth Amendment read, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, no warrant shall issue but based upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, except in the case of national security, or except in the necessity to enforce the law, or except in the case of exigent circumstances, or except when it's just too inconvenient? You will find none of these exceptions within the Fourth Amendment. And yet, those in government assert that each and every one of those exceptions exists. How is that so? Because the people have allowed those in government to define the limits of their own power. So those in power define those limits as limited only by their need, necessity, and convenience. Every added exception to your right to property is one devised by those in government, by a law, by executive order, by regulation, or court opinion, to expand government power beyond its defined limits to decrease the liberty and the rights of the people. I want you to think about something for a second. If we had been teaching this history and the proper application of the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment for the last 150 years, how much different would life be in America? Would the people tolerate the Patriot Act, the NDAA power of indefinite detention, the government reading our emails, text messages, or listening to our phone conversations? Would the people simply ignore the cameras on the roads documenting our passengers and our travel? How would the federal government ever get away with the crime upon liberty they called civil asset forfeiture? If this course was required learning for all Americans, would Americans allow the federal government to classify an 100-mile border around the United States as the Constitution Free Zone, where Border Patrol agents are taught they need no warrants and no probable cause to search and seize Americans? If this course was required learning for all Americans, would Americans allow the federal government to classify the seas and oceans within and beyond American territory as Constitution-free zones, where American Coast Guard agents are taught they don't need warrants, probable cause, or even permission to board American vessels and search and seize to their heart's content? What has happened to liberty in the last 250 years? We have allowed our fear to trump our liberty. Our founders worked very hard to create a federal government that would be locked in a limited and defined box. We, their descendants, have turned around and handed the government the keys. Exigent circumstances, roadside checkpoints, national security, officer safety are expansions of government power written by government-paid lawyers, allowed by government-paid judges, and used by government-paid agents, all justified by safety, security, law enforcement, or the war on drugs. We have succumbed to the fear factor, believing trading liberty to keep us safe is the primary role of government. No, it's not. The primary role of government is not national security. It is, as the Constitution clearly mandates, liberty security, as in to preserve the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. But remember, necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. No truer words were ever penned by William Pitt. However, here we are today, accepting the government's argument of necessity. And out of ignorance and arrogance fueled by fear, we do not see they are revealing themselves to be tyrants, and we are allowing ourselves to be slaves. Simple grammar, a little history, and the entire Fourth Amendment becomes abundantly clear.